You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Nagyan Laka Ariasa. So, Nagyan, tell me, who are you?
What a deep question. So,
or you can blow it off. I mean,
I'm Nagyan. I'm someone who feels very deeply. So I laugh from my belly. I think deeply about issues. I try to be lighthearted about things that don't matter. Uh-huh. And, you know, I'll cry at a sunset if it's beautiful. So I consider myself someone who, in that sense, feels very deeply.
You are and also is fully present and accounted for at each moment.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. And so what other ways might we kind of appreciate you from an outset?
Sure. So yeah. I identify as Muslim, and I'm an American, and my parents identify themselves as Puerto Rican American and Albanian.
Uh-huh.
So I definitely think I carry those identities with me wherever I go, in the music I listen to, in the food I eat, in my mannerisms, the music I like to dance to. So all of that, I think, plays into those identities.
You cross cultural lines that I have not known
crossed. And to make matters worse, my husband was born in Venezuela, but he is culturally Chilean, and that actually influences my daily life as well.
Sure. Yeah. Wow. Wow,
that's talk about a melting pot.
Yeah. And also with delight.
I mean, absolutely.
And one of my friends prefers to talk about the stew, or the salad, or whatever, because there are all these pieces and they don't necessarily fold into each other, which is I guess part of your point.
Yes.
So, what would you like to start with musically today?
Ooh, that's a good question. Let's start off with the salsa, because I think that throws people off the most, that I am, in fact, a Muslim who identifies as Latina.
Okay. Okay. Let's go there, and then we can talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
Okay, the piece is Joe Arroyo and Rebellion.
Oye, men, no le pegue a la negra.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Nagyan Laka Ariasa. So where I'd like to go is how, given all of those identities and the implied experiences and the learning, you know, how is it that you have cobbled together what makes sense to you? What, how do you put those experiences together? And when did you learn to start doing that?
It's funny that you say that, because I spent a lot of time, well, I think as a child, I think many people have this experience where they think, who am I? How do I put myself in a box? When someone asks you who you are, how do you give a one-sentence spiel? And I could never do that, because I couldn't just say I'm American. People would look at me and say, well, your skin's a different tone. What does that really mean? What are the implications of that? But you're a Muslim, so how can you be American? So there was always a follow-up question.
Right.
And I finally started to realize that there is this great thing called humanity that crosses cultures. Compassion and feelings, delight, those are things that all people can experience. Uh-huh. And wherever the influence comes from, for me, so if there's a social norm that's coming from Albanian culture, like hospitality, for example,
yes,
anyone else can appreciate that. I'm sure they'll be delighted that I'm, you know, stuffing their plate and offering coffee and tea. And
right.
So it was something that might be expected in Albanian culture, but delightful and new to others. So who I am, while it is influenced in a mosaic of different cultures, I think can be appreciated by different people. And, you know, I've heard that once you hit 30, you just give up on trying to please people and you just are who you are. So I got a head start on that and decided I'm just going to be who I am. And either people will like it and I'll have really close friends, or they won't and we'll just keep moving along.
Right. So the question didn't have to give in to giving a simplistic answer. But how, okay. So how do you hold yourself in a way that may differ from how other people hold themselves?
I don't know. Things like this always confuse me, because I think, well, aren't I just like everyone else? And then people meet me and they say, no, you're not, but I don't understand the difference.
Okay, so let me rattle on for just a second here.
Go because, for it.
The music that you just... played was from Colombia, which was where I lived as an exchange student.
Mm-hmm.
40 years ago, and it was incredibly put me on a sentimental journey, because that's I learn through music and motion, and I'm also very much a visceral kind of person, which is not a heart or a mind person. It's more basic than that. The other piece is I lived in the Bronx for a number of years in the 80s, and I had a landlord who was ethnic Albanian from mm-hmm. the former Kosovo.
Mm-hmm.
And he had in his apartment, in this 72-unit apartment building that he had managed to buy and to slowly improve a little bit while he drove a bus during the day, a commuter bus from
sure.
Westchester into New York. In the early, mid-1980s, when I was living in that building, in this building had people who spoke 18 different original languages. They came from all over the world, and he made a point of putting up symbols of Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, on the wall near the mailboxes, so that everybody got to see something that was relevant to them, visually represented in the building. And I was going to seminary at the time and working.
Mm-hmm.
It was just very moving to me. And I wrote my rent check out for years to Kosovo Realty. there were connections. There were pieces of different lives coming together that he was assembling quite intentionally. My sense is that you are both now to get back to you more directly, when do you experience, how do you experience, How do you, when you feel most satisfied with yourself,
mm-hmm.
how do the pieces feel like they're coming together? And when you feel at odds about things, where is it that the fractures are taking place?
You're not helping me with this, Eric, and here's why. Because sure. for me, when I feel most satisfied is when I'm being of service. And again, that crosses cultural lines. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
No. But it's the service that integrates. It's the action.
Sure.
That integrates. And so when you what you just told me is that when I'm actively using all these parts and they're all moving together,
mm-hmm.
that's what I'm interpreting. And I don't know if that's what you meant or not. But that's when you feel comfortable, when you're not self-consciously divided.
Sure. I think, that's the, so what you're describing about, this landlord is something that's hard for me to qualify. So I grew up living different cultures. So
at the same time,
Yeah. And so I never thought of it as, this leg of mine is Albanian and this leg is Puerto Rican. So I suppose I'll give an example of a time when I'm really content is during religious holidays.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure as most families, the thing to do is to eat food.
Mm-hmm.
And our plate will have Chilean, you know, pastel de choclo on it. And then we'll have some Albanian lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I get giddy in those moments because I can see the mosaic on a plate in a way mm-hmm. that I can't see it in myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what word choices I use that come from what culture or what mannerisms I have until someone points it out to me and says, wow, you know, look at this sassy Puerto Rican coming out of you. But those are all stereotypes as well. So I can't say, well, this is what it looks like when it all comes together.
Yeah.
I think I'm definitely aware of making other people feel comfortable because I have felt what it's like to be excluded or to say you're not enough of this culture. Enough of that culture.
Right. And when you model graceful presence
mm-hmm.
and graceful movement,
mm-hmm.
What's called in traditional Christian language, unself-conscious grace.
Okay.
That makes other people be able to be unself-conscious.
Oh, absolutely.
And more direct.
Yep.
And that's beautiful. Yeah, yeah.
I hope that I'm that for other people.
and it sounds like when you are happiest, that would be where you are, and that's why it's hard to describe. Because when it's unself-conscious grace, you can't label it. The minute you start labeling it, you take yourself out of it.
Sure.
It's like a meditation. Once you become too aware of it, mm-hmm. you can't do it.
And for example, I'm thinking of one of the moments most recently where I was in just total bliss. I was on a beach in the evening with my husband. We had just celebrated 10 years of being married together. What does that have to do with any culture? Being on a beach, you can be anywhere.
Yeah.
Being married, you can be anywhere. So I can't say it was one influence or one experience as opposed to another. It was just a beautiful universal moment.
Yeah, and it all blends. It happens concurrently.
Yep.
Serendipitously. So, tell me, where are you from? Where did this happen? And where did you? How did you move through space? You know, where have you lived in a certain sense?
Okay.
And what does it mean to be from all the places and sensibilities that you're from? If you know.
Sure. And I'm gonna push back and say where I'm from is New Jersey.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's where I'm from. I lived in New Jersey.
And that's not a pushback. Okay. That just says that there is more in New Jersey than stereotypes admit.
Oh, absolutely. We're not just smelly landfills, I'll have you know. New Jersey is a place. New Jersey for me is the salad. You know, when we talk about uh-huh. the melting pot versus the salad, it's totally the salad. There are neighborhoods of all different communities. It's actually quite interesting. I was right where I was supposed to be. I was raised in Union City, where the population is mostly Hispanic and a trickle of Muslims, mostly Arab Americans. But bright place for us to be. And then after graduation, my husband and I moved to Fairview, New Jersey, which again is half Latin American and half Eastern European. So I had, you know, my Albanian neighbors, I had my Turkish neighbors, I had my Armenian neighbors. There was a little bit of everything, and that felt like home for me.
Yeah.
And now I live in Ithaca.
Right. Which is 80% white, non-Hispanic.
Yes.
But it's but there are we are more religiously diverse than we are racially or culturally diverse on some levels. That's a different topic. I grew up in a place that would look from the outside like the melting pot.
Okay. You know,
a white rural community in Northwest Missouri, where most of the people were over the age of 65 because the young people were leaving in droves because there wasn't the kind of opportunity that they could find in cities. And yet those people, there was more diversity among those people because they were opinionated, they had space that they occupied, they didn't agree, and they only looked like a melting pot to outsiders.
Okay.
And when they became defensive, they would stand with each other.
Sure.
But not because they necessarily agreed, but just because they loved each other. If you know what I mean.
Yes.
And we confuse sometimes, you know, so I grew up in a salad bowl, but the salad, the ingredients didn't look so very different until you actually tasted them.
Well, and I think that is the issue with an outsider looking into a community, because yeah. I'm sure someone would think that about the Bronx.
Yeah.
Yes,
well,
but parts, you don't,
or particular neighborhoods in the Bronx.
Yes.
It's just not visually different.
Except if this group is Puerto Rican and that group is Dominican and that group is Colombian, they are different. Yeah. Just because you think they look the same or they're united by a language doesn't necessarily mean they are. So just because you think it is doesn't mean it is.
Right. Right. No, that's that. Yeah. And that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You brought some more music with you.
Yes.
What would you like to go to next?
I'm trying to be nice and go with the flow, so maybe we'll go with the Albanian music, just so you can, since we mentioned that, we can go
but,
in that direction.
Well, but you can also be kind of not nice.
Okay, I'll not be nice.
What do you, I mean, and you know, so it's your choice.
Let's do Hole Celebrity Skin.
Okay.
No, it's not Celebrity Skin, it's Hole, Violet.
Violet, yes. Here we go. And do you want to comment, just save comments for that afterwards, or do you want to comment on it before we play it?
Oh, we can chat afterward. I'll let the music speak for itself.
The sky was made of amethyst, and all the stars were just like little fish. You should learn when to go. You should learn how to say no.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Nagyan Laca Arriaza. So you wanted to push buttons with that selection.
Yeah.
So tell me, what buttons did you just push?
Well, I'm very curious to see how many people turned down the volume or stopped listening at that point. But I wanted to show the dynamic of people, right? So I'm a Muslim and I'm a female, and usually people think that I'm supposed to be very quiet in a corner, and I'm not. I am vocal. And I have, you know, I have feelings. I get angry.
Right. And you're also, and the video that goes with that song is a partially clad woman part of the time in this saying that, you know, when people get what they want, which is a reference to sex, then they don't want it anymore. Or it's a reference to a whole bunch of other things, too, because it's an attitude about life. When you're involved in the conquest, you really don't care about the relationship. And that's what it. What it says is that, to me, is that you can have that hard-edged appreciation for reality and still be an incredibly effervescent, kind and gracious person.
Sure. Because, and for and for me, you know, when I remember being a teenager listening to that music and being angry and really feeling like, you know what, just take it all. It was like, you know, it was that spite, giving someone poison, you know, drinking poison, expecting someone else
to die.
To die.
Yes.
And now for me, it's more about, I have accepted that that's not reality, right? I don't have to succumb. I don't have to give it up to you anymore. I'm going to do whatever I want. And this time I'm going to do it with pride instead of insecurity and not being sure and acting out of spite, but out of that grace and comfort.
And with an attitude that I'm in it for the long haul.
Oh yeah.
This is not something that's going to flame out, you know, and so it needs to be sustainable.
Yep.
And passionate at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how did you get from New Jersey to Ithaca?
So I was accepted into Cornell University. I studied there for 4 years. I did my undergrad degree there. And actually, at the time, I had just gotten married, and I think that's part of why I say I feel deeply, right? I met someone, and I was like, I love you. This is it. We're in it for the long haul. So I was married as an undergrad. We went back to New Jersey after I had graduated. Then my husband got accepted to Cornell, so we came back. And then I found work, so once he graduated, we decided to stay here. So what they say is true, I guess. If you are a student at Cornell, you end up marrying another Cornellian, even if it's after work.
I don't know if it's still true, but 15 years ago, it was still true that something like half of people who go to college will meet their first spouse through that college, whether or not it happens then or 10 years later.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's still true, but it was true.
So we did ours backwards. We already met, but we just stuck a degree on both of them.
So what is it like? What makes your life and the challenges that you run into worthwhile here in Ithaca? Because you've had several different jobs here in Ithaca. And what about being here gives you energy? So, more than takes it away? Because I'm sensing that you would flee if it took more away than it gave.
Yeah, I am definitely someone who is, you know, rational and logical. I'm goal-oriented. So if I found that the energy put in wasn't, you know, producing enough, I wouldn't do that. So Ithaca's small enough that you can actually get to know someone, or if there's a solution, if there's a problem, you can find a solution. So because I work in the nonprofit area, so I currently work at the Greater Ithaca Activity Center. I was previously at the Southside Community Center. I'm connected to a lot of resources. If you need a bus pass, I know who to call.
Right.
If you're looking for housing, I know who to call. I understand who's on the list and who has the leverage. So that's an amazing way for me to actually solve problems.
Right.
Where I grew up, it was much more crowded. If you didn't know someone, yes, things moved a little slower, but how would you ever know anyone to make those moves? I think the networking is much more powerful here in this community.
It's possible to really, we're not so big that we what I had to discover, my experience of Ithaca was extremely hostile. I shouldn't say Ithaca. Well, at Cornell, if you identified as a devout, even as a devout liberal Christian in the late 1970s, you would be ridiculed. So people hid all sorts of pieces of their identity.
Sure.
And I, and also, if you weren't going to kind of toe a traditional line, like the stereotype of the box they wanted to put you in, it made mm-hmm. you were a target. And I chose, and I, because I came out of rural poverty and didn't speak proper English and didn't have some of the study skills, it was really kind of hard to figure out how to navigate in both worlds
mm-hmm.
When I had more in common with the cleaning service people than I did with the faculty and the other
sure.
students. So, and Ithaca was a fairly hostile place to be in terms of public debate in the 80s.
Mm.
And things began to get more civil and more respectful in the 90s.
Okay.
And it's continued the same way to now, where it's possible to relate, raise religious issues and have even the staunchest non-religious folks behave in, and actually, I think, be respectful
mm.
of the differences, because we've begun to learn enough that we can work across those. And for me, Ithaca is a microcosm of a place where we can do some real diversity that is around values as opposed to around images.
Sure.
And it's not about appreciation, and it's about working within other people's understandings and making a point of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is also the other part of why the networking is so powerful, because you'll eventually see me in the street
mm-hmm.
And you can say hello and ask me questions regardless of what your religious background is. And I think Ithaca provides a stage to have that and to build that intimate relationship with someone you honestly otherwise wouldn't get to know.
Right, right. In the, I was, in terms of wearing the hijab,
mm-hmm.
There was a woman at Cornell who was an older, you know, middle-aged researcher in the late 80s and 90s, who was the only woman at Cornell who wore a head covering. I befriended her because I understood part of that. My mother, also as a peasant Christian woman in many ways, wore a head covering until 1970, 71,
mm-hmm.
when people ridiculed her so much that she finally gave it up.
Sure.
Including her daughters, who were turning 30 at that point and had kind of, were liberated, and mm-hmm. they weren't, you know, they saw it in a different way than, anyway. So I have kind of these feet, we have become more open. Here. It's not entirely open, but we have become a little more open.
I think people are open, but they're still making assumptions. So
yeah.
I feel like people look at me and say, I'm open to your conservative, my idea of Islam. And I'm
yeah.
like, well, are you open to my, you know, whole music? Are you open to that too? Are you open to the idea that I'm a dynamic person and not just a woman in hijab, and that means different things people?
Right, and it doesn't mean subordination of women inherently.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean all sorts of
no
these
one forced
other things.
Me to put, you know,
yeah.
put the hijab
yeah, yeah.
on. I'm not oppressed. This is my choice.
Right. But the thing is that you have, and this is a bigger thing than Ithaca. In order to move from being open to being nimble at getting to know you, you
mm-hmm.
need to model that. And the part of this reason this show exists is to do this conversation
sure.
that we're having, so that
yeah.
actually people can hear it happen, and this is what it looks like on
mm-hmm.
some level. But the other part is that we live in a culture that doesn't encourage people to take the kind of time it takes to appreciate the complexity of the people around them.
Sure.
And doesn't, and oftentimes presumes a privacy and secrecy where it really ought to be what's personal but open to the community.
And I also feel like I think a lot of people are in this mode right now where, like, let's go make friends with the Muslim so we can show how progressive and integrative we are. And my pushback is, do it out of your heart and in a way that makes sense. So do you pick up friends at the grocery store? Or do you just walk up to strangers and say, I want to be my friend? And I feel like that it's forcing it a little
right.
at this point.
Yeah, yeah, no. And believe you me, I have been friends with people in the Muslim community here since 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that sense from newcomers that when I reach out, because it's part of my whole life.
Sure.
So there's nothing particularly taken on now about it. And it's been part of I went to seminary not to be a Christian minister serving Christian communities, to be of service to the whole of people and to make translations where people didn't understand.
Sure.
So about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I did a report on diversity in Tompkins County and used as an illustration the diversity within the Muslim community, because at that point there were some really strong conflicts because people were trying to decide around an Islamic center / mosque and a chaplain and all these, and that's a lot oriented towards Cornell, but there's a lot of downtown stuff and there's race issues that, you know, they're not supposed to be there, but they're there, you know, within, and I was trying to describe, this is a beautiful, rich mosaic of many different political and religious points of view.
Absolutely.
And as outsiders, to be supportive of that, we need to support them all, because they have to work out these conflicts among themselves.
Sure.
When the secularists want to take the sides of the more, quote, non-religious Muslims in these conflicts, it just creates a bigger mess.
Sure.
And so what I'm trying to do is to encourage people to get to know the breadth and depth of all of our neighbors. And because of the politics today, Muslims are under a microscope and have been off and on for 20 years.
Yeah, I like to joke that we're the new communists, right? Before, you could call everyone a communist. Now, I call everyone a Muslim. It's a bad word.
Yes. You're provocative. And for me, what I like to provoke is the only system of government that works completely by consent is anarchy. Where everybody only does what they consent to, and they can't coerce anybody else.
Sure.
And yet that is in some sense an admirable ideal. In practice, there are times when things need to move faster than people can choose.
Sure.
So that's pushing buttons. Where should we go next musically?
Let's do Albanian music so I can give a shout out to my, dad's side of the family.
Okay.
This will make them happy.
Very good. And let me do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest is Nagyan Laka Ariaza. So Nagyan, what about Albanian music?
Oh, it's great. How can you stand still after listening to that?
I can bounce in my chair.
So that is what's called a shota or a vale. And it's not like people go, you know, if you went to Albania right now, you wouldn't hear that on every radio station. It's a specific traditional line dance, so the melody's a little different. If you went to Albania now, you'd hear techno and rock and all of the rest.
Right, yeah, because it's integrated. But this is mm-hmm. this is the back to your roots music.
Yes, this is what we play at weddings, and I have a big family, so that for me, that's nostalgia. Every time I hear that music, it makes me want to get up and dance and, you know, celebrate something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, how have you, as you have lived out loud, which I think is a very appropriate expression for you, how have you had to change in ways that you wouldn't have anticipated?
Sure.
Or maybe wouldn't have chosen, but you've learned that it was important.
So I was actually very quiet as a child. Being the youngest in a large family, I didn't see really the point in being expressive. I wanted to be accommodating. And then in school, I realized I want to be a leader. And leaders are people who speak out, and you have to be at the forefront, and you have to run for class president and do all these things. And as I did that more and more, I enjoyed it, and I saw that people were starting to turn to me to say, well, what do you think? What are you going to do? What should we be doing? Guide us. Mm-hmm. And then it moved into, well, I guess I'm going to have to become more articulate. I can't just say whatever I want. I can't be as sarcastic. I can't, you know, be as cheeky sometimes, maybe. And then I backed away and thought, well, I'm just going to be myself. Mm-hmm. I'm still cheeky. I'm still silly. But I have an important message, so I will still be in the forefront. And I've had to accommodate, how do I come off as elegant and graceful and still be myself and really be genuine without feeling like I'm being stiff and every word I say is measured.
Right, right. And so you have to feel comfortable in your skin in this more visible role.
Yes. And there are also accommodations in terms of who I meet and where I go. Maybe I'll wear a suit instead of a tunic, and maybe I won't wear a dress that day because I think it'll fill the stereotype. So I have to be really more conscious of my actions and, mm-hmm. and what I look like.
Right. But also when you make the choice to, I'm not going to be among the sea of participants because I have something that the others don't that needs to be out there. How do you perceive your relationship, the relationship between leaders and participants or leaders and followers? What is that for you? Because that is a really it's an awkward transition too.
Sure.
It's a power transition.
Yes, absolutely. So what I always do first is I sit back. If a question is proposed, so even if it's, oh, someone wants to have an event, let's do a block party, I always sit back first. If no one volunteers, then I will step forward. So for me, it's like, you've already selected me by your silence. So that to me is a form of getting buy-in. I don't crown myself the king.
Right.
I wait until others say, Nagyan, can you do that? Or push me in that direction. I don't want to come off as pompous or arrogant mm-hmm. or think mm-hmm. that I actually know. It's not that I know more or less. I'm simply willing.
Right, right. And so that helps me to understand how you you are a second-hand initiator.
Okay.
Allowing there to be a first-hand, and mm-hmm. if it doesn't go to, I mean, in terms of just process, in terms of traditional culture, if there was someone who was deeply moved, then that person would speak up, and then the group would assess.
Sure.
Where you know, is this the right person? Is this the right
mm-hmm.
time? But when the group sits in silence, then it draws leadership out. Then once you are in that role, how do you handle the power dynamic going forward? Once you are either the, you know, how do you describe your role, your practice as a leader?
My goal is to be an orchestrator. So you do what you do really well. Why would I try to do what you do or tell mm-hmm, you what mm-hmm. to do? I'm asking you for help, really.
Right.
Can you play this instrument? Can you come forward and help with this component of the project?
Right.
I need you. So for me, it's a mutual exchange. My skill set is orchestrating, not right. to have every skill set. So for me, it's actually a team where we're all working together. The difference is that I'm looking at the big picture, you know, calling you to come forward or to move back as needed.
Right. And how do you perceive, backtalk? How do you deal with when you run into a situation and the orchestra is seeing something different than you're seeing? How do you navigate that?
I actually love that. It concerns me if the orchestra's too quiet.
That's, yeah, well, we're on the same page there.
I always tell, I tell my coworkers, I've told my assistant, I want you to fight me on things. If I'm wrong, tell me.
Yeah.
Because I'm not too proud to say, oh, actually, you're right. We should do it that way. That makes more sense.
Right, right. So to frame that in terms that I use, I want to be a force to be reckoned with. I don't want to bowl people over, and I don't want to be a doormat.
Sure.
But I want to be a force, and orchestrating is especially seeing what's missing.
Yes.
Which is the kind of the key skill there. It's more than it's as much as seeing and valuing what you have. It's seeing what's missing.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, a big part of it is being able to have enough skill that I can fill that spot temporarily
sure.
until you can find somebody or some group that can step in and own it.
Absolutely. And I think too, now that you mentioned that, something that happens for me is, yes, I'm a female and I'm 5'4". I don't look very intimidating, but my father taught me at a very young age to use my tongue. So I can
And you're
get,
the younger of brothers or the younger of
I'm
brothers
the younger
and sisters?
Of sister. I have an older sister than myself. Yeah. And so with there is that pushback and you're not getting the picture and you're not understanding that actually what I'm, you know, there's more information.
Yeah.
I will divulge that information, or that's when I, you know, that's when I push back.
Yeah, yeah. And what have you had in taking that kind of role? There are times when one has to seek forgiveness because you pushed a little too hard.
Sure.
How did you learn to do that? How have you learned to do that?
Oh, how did I learn to do that? Through mentorship. So I'm involved in mentorship in the community, and I have a guide. I have someone who helps me, and something she taught me is, first off, so in order to avoid those situations, you must be kind and honest, not one or the other.
Right.
And so that helps curb a lot of the coming off as nasty, because
right. yep.
I have to really think before I speak. And then the other is, if you do something wrong, you don't say, I'm sorry. You have to actually amend it. You have to fix the situation.
You have to address it directly.
Yes. Okay. So if it's something, this has happened before, I raised my voice, so I went to the person and apologized. But it doesn't mean I can raise my voice again. It means from here on in with that person, I need to understand, you know, that I can't do that anymore.
Right. It doesn't work for that person, with that person.
Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, I apologize and then fix it.
Yeah. And is the mentorship, where is the mentor, is the mentorship a local program or is it?
It's through a national network. There just happens to be a local chapter and, I won't talk about it much, but
sure.
if you see me in the street and you want to know more, I'd gladly divulge that.
Okay. Yeah. Good. One of the things that we desperately need, given you know, this election cycle particularly, is both candidates are unable and unwilling to lead the whole of the nation.
Sure.
They don't have hearts or connections that are big enough to embrace the pain and the hope and the obstinacy that's out there.
Sure.
That seems like a problem that's worth addressing to you.
Of course.
But a lot of people, it's not even a problem worth addressing.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying? Because they just, they resigned to partisanship.
Well, and I think the reason I see it as so important is because I have had the feeling of being excluded.
Yeah.
And I've also had the wonderful and refreshing idea of having someone, like you described, put up a symbol or show some effort for being included.
Right.
And so I understand how powerful that is. You can change someone. Like, my boss did that for me. I am now a stronger person. I'm more comfortable in my skin. There's untapped power and resources in people when you make them feel comfortable.
And when they are all productive sensors and creators of the community that
absolutely.
They live in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think a lot of what we see now in the political climate is fear. People are acting on fear. Mm-hmm. And so if you create that safe space, maybe that diminishes and the whole attitude changes.
Yeah. Let's cut to music, and then I want to talk more about your own personal spiritual practices.
Okay.
But what should we play next?
One
of these MIA pieces, or
sure, why not? And I'm up for either. You can tell me which one ever you like better.
Let's do Go Off.
Okay.
Okay. And it's not because I like it better; it's just because there was just something about the tune. That
I won't judge you if you like it better.
I know that. I'm just being honest. No focus, lost, I cost a trick, you tell you got it wrong.
People are positioned, I said we up on the level, like my name is Neymar, and you know I'm the number. There is no competition, I'm gonna tap and you're gonna listen, I'm on 10 like man, even better than them, yeah. I don't need fuckers like a German cause fan. My third eye's open and my fuckers ain't joking. Yeah, you get it wrong, cause my fuckers is so strong. No focus, lost, I concentrate, and now you got it wrong. Go off on them. Go off on them. Lost a concept, trick, you tell you got it wrong. Yeah, I'm pressing buttons, dropping pins on positions, cause my words go far and this rain is so foreign. You blow the place I live in, watch, I could keep it going, go off on them. So check up on the messages, know what the message is. Like alien in villages, we're here for all ages. Fans back home, got my tracks bang long. Yeah, you get it wrong, cause my focus is so strong. Focus, lost, I concentrate, and now you got it wrong. Go off on them. Go off on them. Now focus, lost, I concentrate, and now you got it wrong. Go off on them. Go off on them. Now focus, lost, I concentrate, and now you got it wrong. Lost, I concentrate, you tell you got it wrong. Please you tell your children I came from London. Stop talking about me like I'm telling she was random. When I was in your life, I like I was hella bomb, but I had to go off just to stay strong. Strong.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Nagyan Laka Ariaza. Nagyan, so the way I like to close the show is to have the guest address this question. What do you do on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, basis to take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually, which I think to me add up to spiritually?
Sure.
What do you do to kind of get things in perspective, and when do you know you need to do it?
Oh, good question. So for me, constant prayer is really important. Something as simple as saying under my breath, like, "Thy will not mine be done." Or just saying, in the name of God, everything I'm doing is for God. So if I'm wrong, I'm giving it my best. And that helps me to realize, first of all, I'm not in control all the time.
Right.
So it's really not that important. Mm-hmm. To slow down and to put it out there. I think it's really powerful to realize that we're actually not as powerful as we think we are.
Mm-hmm.
Things kind of fall into place. And then physically.
Sometimes we're the piece holding them out of place. Sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a tendency to be stubborn, and it's important for me to let go sometimes and say, okay, it's not going to happen right now, and that's okay. And for me, prayer is meditation. Just having enough time to be quiet long enough to listen to myself and to sort things out. Physically, I play soccer. This is something new for me. I've always played sports, but it's been a year now that I started playing soccer, so I play in the Ithaca Open League. No, not Open League, because that means something else. I play in the Ithaca League, co-ed.
Okay. Neat. So you used an expression which is a translation of the Arabic, but it's also a traditional Christian phrase, "Thy will, not mine, be done."
Mm-hmm.
That is the traditional Christian way of framing it in English.
Sure.
And it is at the heart of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mindset.
Yes.
As well as a physical way of moving in the world that you've described. What you didn't mention was how do you treat your emotions? How do you take care of that piece of your life?
Oh, how do I? I think I used to, eat cake to address my emotions. but I grew out of that, thankfully. And now it's talking things out with friends just so I can sort through my thoughts, and eventually I'll realize, oh, I'm just sad. I keep trying to push this thing aside and, be more productive.
But the sadness is overwhelming.
Yes, and I've realized it's taken me long enough, I guess, that that's okay to sit in my emotions, to actually experience them. I think I spent a lot of time shoving them aside so I could keep moving forward. And now I've slowed down to say, okay, I need a moment to be sad, and it'll pass and it'll come and go. That's just, that's something human that I didn't realize is necessary. In that sense, I think I've been naive.
Right. But I think also what you have just said, as a personality, people who have real trouble with sadness are those who tend to be really intellectual or those who tend to live in this visceral realm, because the visceral realm is primal.
Sure.
And that more refined notion of sadness you don't know where to make it fit, because it doesn't hit one of those primal buttons.
Sure. And I think to myself, how is this productive?
Well, yeah,
you're not doing anything with it.
And people who live out of the visceral primal sense have incredibly powerful vocations that they are, they're whether they're peacemakers or revolutionaries or perfectionists or challengers as you, that's what they know.
Sure.
And it takes time. How old were you? How did you discover sadness?
Oh, wow. You're going to have to make this show a lot longer. So my father passed away when I was about 15 years old, and it wasn't until my freshman year in college that I actually think I experienced the sadness of that event.
The grief.
Yes. I had spent so much time just like, gotta pick yourself up by your bootstraps, gotta keep going to school, gotta make the next step, help mom around the house. And it wasn't, I was watching some movie about father and daughter, and I just started crying. I was like, what is this? Where has this been? Yeah. This is not productive. What do I do now with this? And I think that was my first genuine experience of, okay, you need to let some steam off. You can't keep holding it. You can't just be a pressure pot. These feelings are there. You're just choosing not to express them.
Yeah. And you did that at 18, 19 years of age or 20.
Sure. Yep. Cornell. Around that age.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. My father died when I was 8.
Mm-hmm.
I have 5 older siblings. Only one of them was home, my older brother, who was 15.
Mm-hmm.
When he left, the burden of carrying my younger brother, in terms of my mother, was not really able to kind of manage without kind of us all pulling very hard together. So I took on that role. And again, not until college or shortly thereafter did I understand the grieving. But we weren't so self-conscious about grief or sadness then, so it took me longer to kind of come to appreciate the role that sadness has in expanding the space for joy.
Absolutely. And the sense of relief of finally letting it go and letting myself experience that. Yeah. And something I want to note, I think everyone in my family, I can't be 100% sure, but I'm rather sure that we all thought we had to take on this additional responsibility. So I thought I was saving them. They thought they were saving me.
Yes.
And so I...
And nobody was sitting down and just weeping.
Exactly.
Yeah. That, I come from a similar family. Yeah. What do you do... Have you found it interesting to explore some of the other emotions?
Yes. So in college, I didn't understand what to do. I kept having this problem, and I didn't know what to do. And I finally went to a counselor, and I was like, I don't know what this thing is. And he was like, oh, you're angry. I was like, oh, is it okay to be angry? Aren't you just supposed to be composed all the time? And he was like, I don't know, punch a pillow. And I tried that, and it was so dissatisfying.
Yeah.
It's too, I need something harder than that. That wasn't taking on me. So I do sports more often now. I yell on the field like a crazy person. That's my time to do that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I stomped on a box that day after going to counseling. I was like, okay, I guess I get this. Now I mumble under my breath or yell at the walls or something. Yeah.
When I was 20, 21, I shot put a cinder block in the backyard.
Oh, my goodness.
Until I couldn't throw it anymore because I would physically exhaust that energy.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I don't know if this is a good or bad thing. I'm still calculated. Like, I assessed that I was going to break a broom because it was a cheap broom, you know, so I'm still thinking it through a little too much. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but I'm like, I should get my anger out on this thing that's not that valuable.
Right. And there's a way in which you can get it out without harming.
Absolutely.
And so that's the judgment that you're trying to make. Because of the poverty that I grew up in as a kid, we couldn't really break stuff without fearing for our stability.
Absolutely.
So we needed to put anger in other places.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's exactly. You have given the most explicit answer that I've ever gotten on that sort of question. You wanted to say a little bit more about your spiritual practice, and especially in leading into our last song here.
Sure. I believe in a public and private life.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, right now I'm vocal and I make jokes. But in my private life, I'm actually deeply spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
I am mumbling, "Thy will, not mine, be done," mm-hmm. under my breath. I do recite what's called sunnah, like things the prophet used to say.
Mm-hmm.
The way in which I do things is thinking about, you know, the accordance of Islam and the rules of Islam. I just don't think that that's anyone's business necessarily. So if you ask me about it, I'm glad to share. But for me, it's something deeply personal.
Right. Yes. And what makes it, in a certain sense, not private, is that it's your personal choice.
Sure.
It's your choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a certain sense, is private. But you're willing to share it because it affects you and the people around you when you practice it or don't practice it.
Absolutely.
And that's what we need to know, that what is our personal thing to make choices about isn't private, because other people they don't get to participate in the choice, but they need to know about it because it shapes how we are with them.
Sure. And I think in some senses for me, like someone said to me once, oh, well, why are you pretending to be religious all of a sudden? I said, the difference is you've just asked me a question, I've answered it.
Yeah.
If you like, this is still happening, you've just never realized it before.
Right. And people don't like it when you say the scales were on your eyes and now they're not.
Sure.
And it's not meant to be that confrontational thing, but that's true. And having grown up in the pietistic, and using that term in the finest form of humble and devotional ways, it was almost impossible for me to find a religious community. I went to the Democratic Socialist Party because mm-hmm. they were the ones that were integrating their personal and public life back
sure.
in the day, and not the Christian community, which was either totally inwardly oriented or social justice, let's go fix the world oriented,
mm-hmm.
which the separation of the two doesn't work for me.
Sure.
So, Nagyan, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And do you want to introduce the singers on this piece?
Sure. So this is a song that was developed by Cat Stevens or Yusuf Islam, and the vocals are by Dawood Ali. And basically we took a nice, soothing, soft song and turned it into what's called Nasheed, which is a religious implicated song or song for praise.
Yes. Praise.
Yeah.
And peace.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah. Silent sunlight, welcome in. There is work I must now begin. All my dreams have blown away. And the children wait to play. They'll soon remember things to do when the heart is young and the night is done and the sky is blue. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah. Songbirds sing away, lending to another day. Bring your wings and choose a roof. Sing a song of love and truth. We'll soon remember if you do, when all things were tall and our friends were small and the world was new. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha for your work has just begun. There'll be the evening in the end, but till that time arrives, you can rest your eyes and begin again. La ilaha illallah.